Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome everybody. It's the Here District, the fantastic voyage as we wind down this 25-26 NBA season. I'm Marcus Johnson, first mate Chris Johnson. We are the only father and son duo still. Still to win a national championship at the same school. Here's a toast to what's that kid's name from UConn? That Braden Mullins. Okay, Braylon to Braylon to Braylon Lachaim. Cheers, Braylon. No, and look, I don't want to be a jerk. I mean, I'd have been happy if they would have won it. I mean, I was cool with, Cameron Boozer, Carlos Boozer, Caden Boozer. I mean, in terms of just us being able to say, you know, we're the only. Now we'd have been one of, you know, we're the only, one of two, you know, or three, however you look at it. But anyway, so I would not have been disappointed if they have won it. But the fact that they didn't still means we get to hold on to that title just a little bit longer. So that's all good. So listen, so we're going to jump right into this Hall of Fame conversation once again. Now, there's some confusion out there. Now, I think I've been a finalist four times. I checked with Grok on the way over here, and she was like, yeah, you've been a six-time finalist. And then I understand from Dylan Carter that some places have me listed as four times, some as six. But the bottom line is I didn't make it. But I wanted to play this clip really quickly of the gentleman at the Naismith Hall of Fame, John DeLiva, who is the angel of death, as I call him, who has delivered the news to me, I think, the last four times. So let's take a quick listen to this, and then we'll come back and comment on that.
Hello, Mr. Johnson. It's John DeLiva at the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame. How are you?
I'm doing good, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Sir, I'm sorry to call you and tell you that you did not receive the required number of votes to be elected to the class of 2026.
Okay.
But that you remain eligible as we go forward. And I would ask for your patience. I know it's been several times with us, and you feel like your patience might be running out, but I would ask you to be patient with us, especially as you move to the veterans category. I think we have some expectations for you in the future, but unfortunately, it won't be this year, sir.
Okay, now with the veterans category, John, so there's a limited amount of votes that you have to get from the media, the regular media, voting media, or is it a veterans? How does that work?
So what we do is a two-step process, and we have a committee called the Screening Committee.
Okay.
And each year there's a veteran screening committee, separate veteran screening committee for people that have been out of the game for 35 years. They are allowed to put one name forth, and this year they chose you, and then you became a finalist. And then what happens is we go to 24 voters that vote by ballot. They get all the biographical information for all of our finalists, and they submit their ballot to us. It's not all media. It can be Hall of Famers. It can be basketball administrators.
All right. So that's John DeLiva. And, you know, I appreciate John, the way he's handled it the last four times. It can't be an easy job, you know. And it's interesting, Chris, just to give people an idea what that day is like. They give you a window, a two-hour window, 11 to 1 p.m. on the Central Time. And so you're going to get a call between 11 and 1. Please make yourself available. So you're sitting there, man, right at 11 o'clock. You know, I've got my iPad ready to record this. I got my Buck shirt on. I got my coffee. And I'm ready to get the news, you know, hopefully the good news that so I can capture my reaction to finally after, you know. But so it's 11:15. 11:30, we go pitch a bitch at 11:30. 11:30, 11:45, 12 noon, 12:15. And so by that time, it's like, man, come on. You know, just sitting there just in terms of a watch pot never boiling and all that. And then the call finally came in. And so the one thing that John did say, and so my initial reaction after getting the news was, man, F this, I'm going to withdraw my name and I'm tired of this and being, you know, they won't have Marcus Johnson to kick around anymore. But after talking with him, he was real optimistic about my chances at some point of getting in. So, what else can I do? And so, I wore my I wore my shirt here. The what goes up goes in, the poster that Adidas had back in the 80s. And I wear this for a special reason, Chris. This is the poster that Michael Jordan had in his dorm room at North Carolina. And as you sent to me when they had the Jordan documentary, what was the name of that? The Last Dance. I don't know. You sent me a clip, kind of serendipiously. You weren't supposed to have it. You're like, Dad, don't show this to anybody. The episode's not coming out yet. So you sent me a clip of Michael Jordan stating, and
I love the Lakers and I love Marcus Johnson.
I love to ask him who his favorites were in the NBA. What'd he say, Chris?
I love the Lakers and I love Marcus Johnson. That's when Jordan had the thing going with the lisp, but he said he loved Marcus Johnson.
It was in the
Last Dance. That was one of the most unbelievable moments because it was a young Mike.
Yeah,
he was in his dorm room, and dude, I was not expecting him to say that. And it's like you had to listen in twice, but yeah, he did say that, dog.
Yeah, yeah. And so I just point that out to say that I was your favorite player. And
hey.
So just kind of put that into the pot and see what you come out with. So anyway.
But MJ, yeah. Real quick, the first thing that Zach Harper from The Athletic wrote about you being in your first 11 years joining that company of guys that, 13,000 points, X amount of rebounds, X amount of assists, high level dudes you, Giannis, Jokic, what I'm saying? It's like only a select few. So the proof is really in the pudding. I don't know what's going on, man. I'm really disappointed for you. It was, it was kind of a sad, just empty feeling when you told me on the phone. It was like, come on, man, this is some BS, but it is what it is, right?
Well, I'm going to be proactive about this because this has been my decision. I can either sit back and wallow and be all, melancholy and blue about this, or I can be proactive. So my mission, if I decide to accept it, that's the old Mission Impossible there, but your mission, Jim, if you decide to accept it, but my mission right now is just to do what I can to educate the current group of basketball pundits about, who I was, my career. And my first step toward that was going on Wikipedia and editing the final comeback player of the year verbiage. They had, they talked about me and drugs and all this. It was the reason that I won it because I'd been through drug rehab in 1982. Jeez. I won the award in 1986. I made an all-star team in 83. I made an all-star team in 86. I won the award in 86. But the way they had it worded was like, because of Marcus's association and Michael Ray and Bernard King? And it was a bunch of guys that had some drug issues that had won that award. So they did away with the award after Marcus won it because, he was a drug addict and we didn't want to have anything to do with drugs with the NBA. And so I actually edited that out.
Good job.
I do that.
Yeah, just set the record straight.
I do that with Wikipedia. I did that with the turn point forward. They had some other stuff in there. I had to go in there and kind of clean it up and make sure that MJ gets his credit. So anyway, enough about me. Doc Rivers, congratulations, Doc Rivers, 6 all time in terms of coaching wins in the history of the game. How can you not put a guy like Doc Rivers? And he's taken a lot of stuff online, Chris, about the 3-1 leads that he has blown, and he's won one championship. I mean, how many coaches have won a championship? You know what I'm saying? They act like winning a championship is something that a bunch of coaches have accomplished. And so I'm really, really happy for Doc. And the other thing about Doc, he told me, John DeLiva told him the same thing about be patient. Last year when Doc didn't make the cut, be patient. You know, your time is coming. But Doc is, 6? He's only 17 wins behind Pat Riley for the number 5 spot. He's 4th all-time in playoff wins, a coach of the year, yada, 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 voted one of the 15 greatest. How can you not
Right,
Doc Rivers in the Hall of Fame, right?
Yeah, sustained excellence, only missed the playoffs 6 times in 27 seasons. Does it as an executive, too. I think that's one of the most important pieces to Doc, the fact that he's also coach and executive at the same time. So, he's definitely a Hall of Famer, and congratulations to Glenn Doc Rivers.
Yeah, yeah. And then one last thing, a couple of last things before we move on. Dick Mata. There was a great article, Jason Quick, I believe, from The Athletic, wrote a great article about Dick Mata. And so when I was talking to John DeLiva, I was like, John DeLiva, being a 4-time finalist, not making it, that's got to be some kind of record. And he was like, well, no, it's not. Actually, there's a guy I just talked to before I talked to you who's been a four-time finalist. I believe it was Dick Botta. I got some research says a three-time finalist, but it just seems like he's been around long enough. So I just want to give a shout-out to Dick Botta. I mean, even though he almost won 1,000, he lost over 1,000, coached some bad teams, expansion teams, just bad teams. But just a great coach, a great man, and the players that I know that had the good fortune to play for him sing his praises. He's still alive. He's up there maybe in his 80s or 90s. He's still doing his thing, Idaho or someplace, weekly breakfasts. It was a great article, Jason Quick. So shout out to him. And then Willie West, our coach at Crenshaw. He was a one-time finalist maybe 5 or 6 years ago, Chris. He's got 800-plus wins. 16 city championships, 8 or 9 state championships, produced a plethora of NBA ball players, myself and John Williams and Darwin Cook and Robert Smith and Stevie Thompson and then Coach Daryl Strawberry in baseball. I mean, you could just go on down the list. So baseball and basketball, actually. And so I would love to see Coach West at least become a finalist again. He's in his mid-80s or so right now, and, health is not great. And so I'd love to see him get another opportunity to, make it into the Hall of Fame. You got high school coaches all over that joint, and, none as, in my mind, very few in my mind as accomplished as him. So, anyway, that's my Hall of Fame talk right now. So let's move on. It is the final point is that, it's almost become like a cottage industry, Chris, and I know Woj used to do this. Give me a call, ask me that I make the Hall of Fame. But these like predicting, what is it that they predict? They're predicting the seeding in the NCAA tournament, predicting all pro teams, predicting all kinds of stuff. Now it's become fashionable to predict who – not predict, but just to find out the inside dirt, the inside skinny on who made it in. And so it's already out there pretty much, the people that have been selected and they're going to – yeah, so it's already out there. So it's all good. It's all good. Anyway, the other point. So, Chris, we were talking on the air about – and bear with me on this. This is a great story. There's a kid, Chris, by the name of Xavier Zins, right? He plays for Wisconsin Lutheran High School.
Okay.
That's the same school that Con Knipple played for. Xavier Zins is Con Knipple's first cousin. Okay.
Xavier Zins
is Con Knipple's first cousin. He plays with the other three Knipple brothers, Cager and Chris, you laugh. They have not lost a game in 2 years. They've won 3 straight state titles.
Wow.
Xavier Zins, 6'7", 23 points a game. He was the Gatorade State Player of the Year as a senior. Okay?
Wow.
23 a game, 7 rebounds, whatever. Really good. You look at some video on him. It's okay. This kid is good. But he signed a letter of intent to go to Northern Iowa, where A.J. Green is from. So I've been talking about that on the broadcast with Lisa Byington. And just because it's just interesting to me, you play with the it's got to be one of the most fundamentally sound teams in the history of high school basketball. You got all these Knipples and the first cousin on the same team. You ain't lost a game in 2 years. You got three out of four state championships or whatever it's been. Con is out of that program, and so I've been talking a lot about it. And so I did a little cursory kind of research on this kid and see that he decommitted because the coach Ben Jacobson, who coached AJ Green, moved on to Utah State. So Xavier Zins decommitted. So he's opened up his recruitment, okay? Our crack media relations guy, who I love, been around forever, 20-plus years, Dan Smiechek, one of the greatest guys in the history of great guys. So Dan Smiechek, Chris, he sent out a media blast saying how the University of Northern Iowa had just hired a new coach, okay? And so I'm reading it, and I'm thinking, well, Dan has really been listening to the broadcast. He knows we've been talking about Northern Iowa, so he's kind of filling in kind of some of the blanks for me in terms of Xavier Zins and why, he's decommitted and who the new coach is. I read about this new coach. It sounds like an interesting fellow, assistant coach at Iowa State, blah, 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 Cal something or other. I'm just kind of reading about him, not thinking too much of it. And then I get to toward the end of the article, and it's like Cal Green has a couple of kids. One of them is A.J. Green. So that's the reason for the article. It didn't have anything to do with me in the broadcast, but it was AJ's dad is now the head coach at Northern Iowa.
Where congratulations.
Yeah. And I'd actually asked AJ about two or three games ago, did he do any recruiting of Xavier Zins for Northern Iowa? And he looked at me kind of weird, like, no, why? I was like, well, this kid, you know, Conkinipple's cousin. No. I mean, I've heard of him, but no. But he probably knew right then that his dad was right there in the mix or had gotten a job.
No.
Who? No. Xavier Zins, no. But here's my question to you. So I just had this premonition. You know, I get prescient sometimes. Man, In the vein of Tony Bennett and Dick Bennett, I just see AJ, 20 years from now, you know, being this great college coach. You know what I mean? I just see him, you know, spending his time in the NBA, however long that's going to be, kind of getting in with his dad like Tony Bennett did with Dick Bennett. And I saw Tony coach his first game when Dick had the flu up in Pullman. They were playing Arizona. Arizona's like number one or two in the nation. And I said, okay, we're going to see what Tony Bennett could do now, you know, going against Arizona, Lute Olson. You know, let me see if his nerves get shot now, replacing his dad on the sideline for one game. And Tony had the greatest kind of courtside manner, coaching courtside manner. You know, the squat with the arms folded, just kind of figured thing. You know, never flustered. It was a close game. They almost beat Arizona. Sure. May have went to overtime. You know, Salim Stoudemire, that crew. I think Clay Thompson might have been there. You know, it was a great game. And he did. That's when I knew Tony Bennett had the chops to be a great coach. And so just kind of an interesting thought, just being, you know, prescient on my part about AJ. I just saw AJ, even though he's a quiet guy, unassuming guy, but I think, you know, with his dad and the fact that, he's played in the league and everything that he's accomplished. And when you listen to him break down the game on post-game pressers, he's really impressive. I mean, he really looks at the game like a coach when I think about it. So we'll see what happens with AJ. And I just thought I'd throw that out there. So did you get a chance to see Usman on the loose man? Did you see any of that game that he played recently?
Yep. Looking good, man. Looking good.
Thoughts on Uz?
Just, you know, I'm liking the reps that he's been getting. I mean, the game that I watched him with the Clippers, I could kind of see him getting in his bag a little bit. But it all came together for me against the Houston. I think that guy has, like I've been saying it all year, he's tremendous upside. Unique forward at his size, ability to handle, run pick and rolls, pass. But the bucket getting ability is really improved since the Bucks have gotten him. I think he's improved, evolved as a scorer. So, yeah, what do you think?
Well, I had a chance to talk to Uz before the Houston game. And so I was asking him about INSEP, you know, that great developmental program over in France. Yeah. So just, you know, give me what was going on over there, man. What's happening with INSEP? So he's explaining it to me that, you know, he was there from the time he was 14 to 17. They do some educational stuff, but it's all about athletic development. A couple of his teammates, Ryan Rupert, and Adama Ball, B-A-L, both play for the Memphis Grizzlies. So that's the kind of competition he's looking at. He said Wimby came through for about 3 months when he was there. And I was like, was Wimby kind of still this freakish kind of, oh, yes, every bit. But the thing that you'll appreciate, and you had this experience in Italy, and I think you've always cited this as one of the reasons why you were able to, you know, excel on that developmental curve. At 14 years old, they're playing against Division III men. You know, they're playing men, Chris, in the French professional league. And so, as I mentioned on the air during the Houston game to Lisa, when you're in that situation, one of two things will happen. You'll either improve or you'll get discouraged and you'll quit. You know what I mean? Mentally, you psychologically, you just, you know, it'll be too much for you and you'll just shut it down, you know, prematurely, or it'll help you get better. And you can see with Usman, he's got a maturity about his game, a confidence about his game, even when he doesn't play well, that I think has really helped him in terms of what he's doing right now. So he went to Oklahoma City, played behind Jalen Williams from Santa Clara, never got the minutes. Sam Presti told me that it was just a matter of opportunity. And, you know, you can look at that, think, okay, you're blowing smoke. Okay, is the kid really that good? But I think pretty much all season long, he's not been the model of consistency in terms of high-level production, but – you could see it in there, and then the culmination. Sure. And the final point, Chris, and your comment on this, it's not like he's doing this, man, when he played against the Rockets, got 36, against D-leaguers, like the Utah two-way game that we got blown out. You know, they had a bunch of two-way M-Bang from Yale and a bunch of these guys. You know, now he's going against KD. He's going against Şengün. He's going against Amen Thompson. You know, Tari Eason, Reed Shepard. I mean, to do it against the number three ranked half court defense in the NBA behind Oklahoma City and the Pistons, which is what the Rockets are, to do it the way he did it against that defense, man, I mean, he had me jumping out of my seat watching this.
Yeah, impressive. 22 years old, like, you know, and the up and down flashes that you saw it during the season. I mean, I'm glad that Doc and that staff continued to play him and continue to empower him. He seems to be empowered at this stage. And, you know, that's the sort of the silver lining for the Bucks. You know, when you don't have much to look forward to, you do have the young Bucks that are hooping, and that gives the entire fan base hope for the future. So I love Jang. I've loved him since he came in the league, but I'm glad to see he's getting those reps, those confident reps. And I think he can continue to kind of springboard his game off of these type of experiences. 36 against KD and them guys, I mean, that does wonders for your confidence. And so I just think, you know, it's all the way up for Usman Jang.
Now, does this stat, so Dylan Carter, you know, he's dug deep into the to the catacombs to come up with some of these stats. Do they resonate
with
you?
Nice one right there.
I'll say three forward centers have ever put up these kind of numbers at 22 or younger: LeBron, Chris Webber, 95, Alvin Adams, a contemporary of mine out of Oklahoma, played for John McLeod at Oklahoma, then played for John McLeod with the Phoenix Suns in 1977. Since 2020, only seven other players aged 22 or younger have put up 36, 10, and 7. Seven players: Luka, Ant-Man, Trey, Stephon Castle, Ja.
Yeah.
This name here kind of surprised me, kind of came out of nowhere. Talen Horton Tucker, the old man.
THT!
The young, old-looking brother. And then B.J. Edgecombe. Does that resonate with you when you read something like that? He's joined this kind of select company.
Of course it resonates. I mean, that's not easy to do. That's esteemed company. I mean, that puts you in the conversation for one of the best young talents in the league. So yes, of course.
Now, and then the final point on that, I'm gotta pull out the stat. So someone on Twitter, I mean, you know, we were you know, hyping up Ooze and the 36 and 10 and 7. And so this guy on Twitter, and I know you guys told me to take it all with a grain of salt, but he made an interesting point. He was like, why are y'all getting so excited about a 36, 7, and 10 game when he was a minus 11 in terms of plus minus? Is that any credence?
No, I don't really think about that type of stuff. I'm looking at the stat line, 37-10. I'm looking at the game. You know what I'm saying? I'm looking at the upside because he's 22.
Yeah.
So whatever that negative minus 11 represented, I feel like he's going to be able to make up for that. I mean, like, dude, I'm not tripping. To do that at 22, that's all I'm thinking about right now. And his size, like, I'm not even worried about none of that other stuff.
So here's the point. And I got to shout out my boy Cormac Ryan too in a minute. But here's the point. Here's the point, Chris. So I'm looking at the stat sheet. So you're telling me that you'd have felt better. I'm talking about this Twitter person out in the Twitterverse, not you.
Yeah.
But if he'd have had Andre Jackson's stat line, 3 for 8 from the field, eight total points, 5 rebounds, 3 assists, he was a +2. So you're telling me that's a better, you know what I mean? That's a better performance than are you saying because of the plus minus discrepancy, Andre Jackson a +9 better than Usman, that he was more impactful in that, you know what I mean? So you gotta keep things in context, fans. When you're looking at this plus minus stuff, don't, you know, it's who's on the floor with you, it's who you're playing against when you're on the floor. And and if Uz would have had, you know, 6 points and been a +5, would you consider that a better? Hell no. I mean, no. I mean, 36, 7, and 10 is 36, 7, and 10.
Yeah,
and the way he got it, the handle, the dunks, the passing. I mean,
That's the main thing.
You get me blind not to see the – yeah, go ahead.
It's the bag. His bag, bro. No, yeah. I'm just saying, like, you don't see a dude that size – with those metrics that he has, the long arms, just the length, the torso, and he's able to, you know, to put up those type of numbers, but playing a really fluid style, man. The Bucks have a gem. This dude is a gem, period. I don't care what his plus minus is, period. And this is, I said this before the 36. I saw it. I see the vision. I see what time it is. So I'm rolling, period. I'm not getting in all that.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And just to, I mean, you got people out there always looking to throw salt on situations like that, to look at the negative side, the glass is half empty, and oh, he was a cool. minus 11. Hey, man, look, you know, he gave the Rocket defense number 3 half court defense in the friggin' NBA behind Oklahoma City and the Pistons. He gave them 30, and they were trying to stop him.
Hey, I was gonna say, you know, Ime is not wasn't going for that. You know, Ime is on one. He's one of my favorite coaches in the NBA.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, he was like, you know, he was locked in. Like, what y'all doing with this dude,
man?
Well,
yeah, you
like,
know, you know, he in the huddle. You letting this MF or French man come out here? Poly Bouffrancé, Sarkozy, Blue, all that bull crap. Y'all need to put him on his ass. I'm paying all five. Put him on his ass. It's on me. I got it. Put him on his ass. You know that. You know Ime. I love Ime.
Me too, dog. I'm rolling.
His team reflects his personality. Okay.
Absolutely.
And then final thing on the Bucks for me. Well, a couple of things. Let's go to Cormac Ryan. C-Mac had a really brief, casual conversation with him, Chris. I knew he played for Stanford and Notre Dame and North Carolina, had bounced around to a couple of high. I didn't really know his backstory. And so, Chris, he got into it with John Collins of the Clippers. He screened out Collins aggressively. Collins kind of flung him out of bounds. They kind of faced off, and Collins, you know, who are you? That kind of thing. And so I asked Cormac about that, and he was like, yeah, you know, I'm just boxing the guy out aggressively. I told him, I'm coming out. Hey, you don't be tripping. I'm coming at you like this. Anytime I have to, I'm going to box you out like that. He didn't back down, is my point. And so I asked Cormac, well, where'd you grow up, man? He's like, Lower Manhattan, New York. You know, he's a Lower Manhattan. I said, did you play at a Rucker? Is it Dykeman or Dickman? What, Dykeman?
The Dykeman.
I thought that was it. So I said that last night. I was hoping I pronounced it correctly. But I played in the Rucker. I played in the Dykeman. I was like, you go against any of the old school? He's like, not really. That was before my time. But I did go see KD come when there was the lockout and drop 50 at the Rucker.
Yeah, I was there. I was there too.
You were there.
When KD dropped 50 something. It was one of the greatest single performances I've ever seen in basketball history.
Was that your days with St. John's and Lav and that whole time?
Yes,
period?
That's when I was out there. I was out there. That performance was incredible.
Wow, small
Turned
world.
It out electric. It's like it was like it probably inspired him.
Yes,
about his love for the game moving forward, because it did that same thing to me. Dog, I'm talking about KD was coming down, knocking down 28, 35 footers on people. The crowd's hype. The dude's on the mic. Everybody's talking. He's walking people down. Yow, yow, like five straight.
Yeah.
From dang near half court. Yeah. So I get it.
And that's what Cormac, and speaking of KD, I don't know if you saw this. You probably didn't. I'll send it to you. But we were about to go on the air for our open for the game, myself and Lisa. And all of a sudden, Chris, I get this hug and clinch from behind. What's up, legend? I just want to come over and pay my respects. So I'm thinking it's like an official. You know, I don't know who it is. So I kind of, you know, brush it off. I look back, and it's KD. It's freaking Kevin Durant.
See, that type of stuff, man. That type of stuff, man.
It's freaking Kevin Durant. What's up, legend? I just want to come over and pay my respects to you,
man.
Dad, you know.
Didn't you do his game against when he was at Texas?
No. This is my KD story. That's close. But I gave him his Wooden Award.
I presented him
his Wooden Award when he was a freshman. And his mother was sitting front row. I opened up the envelope, and everybody was all tense and excited. And I was like, so the winner of the 2000, whatever Wooden Award is. And I looked at his mother, and I said, now it's time to scream. Kevin Durant.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, Lord.
I said, okay,
the
now,
real MVP.
And now it's time to scream.
Ow!
You know, and so, but the backstory with that story is, and I got to make sure the chronology is correct, but I think it was Greg Oden, it was Candace Parker, it was Kevin Durant. We're all back in the back, right?
Jeez.
And Greg Oden is just – got this major crush on Candace Parker. Oh my God, she's you know how big 7 foot goofy guy. Oh, she's so beautiful. Wow, oh, Candace is so beautiful. I was like, go talk to a young fella. Oh no, I could never do that. She's just out of my league. She's so pretty. Oh my God, Candace Parker is so beautiful, so beautiful. So I mean, I'm not gonna say that joke. I might get in some trouble. But
yeah, leave it alone.
Yeah, I'll leave it right there. But so it was just a great conversation, great banter, you know, that we all had backstage right before we went out to announce who won the Wooden Award. So that's my Katie story. But that was a great moment, man. That was a great moment. And the other part of our history is when he came out to Los Angeles to play against Compton Centennial, I went to the game, you know, and everybody went to see Ty Lawson. Ty Lawson was on that Oak Hill team. So everybody's going to see Ty Lawson. And this 6'7", 6'8", gangly, high-waisted, Scottie Pippen lookalike just turned it out. And I went up to him after the game. He was a junior. I was like, man, yeah, man, what's your name? He's like, Kevin Durant. I said, man, you got a great future. Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Then that summer, Fred Smith, the guy that we both worked for, producing a lot of great local basketball stuff, the Basketball Channel, he had me go out to Vegas and cover a game that KD played in, and I interviewed him after the game. He had a great game. I interviewed him, about a 4 or 5 minute interview. We talked about his basketball future and all that. So we've crossed paths enough, and he's funny. Every time I see him, it's like, man, hey, Marcus Johnson, I gave you the Wooden Award. Man, I know who you, man. Come on, man. If you don't stop saying that, man. So we got a really, really good thing going on.
Easy money sniper.
Easy
okay.
money, the Durantula. Easy money sniper, please. And I love the guy. I love how outspoken he is, and I love the fact that he's just opinionated. You know, he lets you know what's on his mind, and takes all the shots and slings and arrows because of it. Now, final point, Ryan Rollins. Okay, we've talked about Rilo, most improved. It's going to be tough. And, you know, speaking with all candor, going to be tough. Jalen Duren is probably the guy. That I think we had. Who do we have? The guy from Michael Grady that does the Amazon. And does the Minnesota Timberwolves. He was going for Nikhil Alexander Walker, I believe, because he played with the Timberwolves, and Nikhil actually has a more improved scoring average from last year to this year over Ryan. Yeah. He's the only one.
Sure,
but all the rest of them, Jalen Johnson, Denny Advia, and Jalen Duren, they don't. But so Ryan Rollins has had just a spectacular season. I made the point last night. Just the fact that he's in the conversation is just – he's the 44th pick in the draft. These other guys were lottery picks. Nikhil was, I think, the 16th, 17th pick in the draft when he came out. He's exceeded the expectations. Now, but here's the point, Christian. This is what I want your opinion on. Doc Rivers talked about Ryan Rollins and how the fact that he's emerged as this number one option mindset type of player – was not necessarily a good thing for Ryan Rollins because, you know, he's saying that how Ryan is the best offensive player, the best option, but when Giannis and the other players get on the floor, it won't be true for him. And so that might be a mental adjustment, a mental kind of a, you know, regression letdown for him when he's got to defer and go back to a complementary role. Do you see that as being an issue?
Wow, that's interesting that Doc said that, but it's also interesting to the concept of like this guy couldn't play multiple roles. You know, you adjust, you adapt. This is the NBA. So there's an established hierarchy, pecking order. Just because you're playing well and get to an established rhythm and groove without Giannis doesn't mean it's going to be the same with that. So I don't think that should be an issue. I think for Rollins, the onus is on him to figure out how to still be impactful and effective with Giannis on the floor. Like, you know, what does he need to do to continue to stay impactful when he doesn't necessarily have the ball and doesn't have the, you know, the reads and the spacing that he typically does? Maybe, you know, he needs to figure out how to impact the game in other ways. Watch some tape on those got Phil Chenier and
Smith.
My guy.
Phil Smith.
So watch some tape on them guys and how they impacted the game, because you know, and I think he can do it. This isn't something that's crazy. And I think Doc's planting that bug in his ear. You know, he's kind of in his mind for his mindset. So like this summer, let's figure out some stuff that you can figure out, you know, and how to play with Giannis and do, you know, get better at cutting and whatever else that might look at, catch and shoot or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah. And I've got to go way out on a prescient wish list. Hopefully playing with Giannis and like A.J. DeBonsta or Cameron Boozer or what's the kid's name from North Carolina? Caleb Wilson.
Wilson. I like
throwing
him.
Lobs to Caleb Wilson. Well, you know, hopefully we get, you know, New Orleans gets the number one pick. We get the number three pick. You know what I mean? Something like that shakes out.
Ooh, top three would be nice.
Oh, man, that'd be incredible. So anyway, but that's it for that. My point about Ryan, he's averaging 17, 6 assists, 5 rebounds. Giannis or no Giannis, Giannis and a great pick or trade piece, whatever. Doc talks about a second all-star. There's room for Ryan to average 17 points a game, no matter who. You know what I mean? 17 is for not sure. Like – if we're talking 25, 23, 26, good 28, point. That's then you're encroaching. You know what I mean? You're encroaching in Giannis's territory.
17 is a good support number.
17
yeah, for sure.
is a great third option. 17, Chris, in the NBA, Giannis at 28, 29, whoever number
yeah,
two
you
is,
need it.
20, 21, as that third option at 17 is a perfect fit.
That puts you over the top. I mean, that makes now you can compete. Now you can compete. Now you can
now
beat
you
folks.
Can compete. Now then it's incumbent upon Doc and the coaching staff. Now you got to pick up the pace. You got to find the ways to you know, like Miami has done in Eric Spoelstra, find the ways to score more, get more shots up, you know, get more offensive opportunities, and then it won't be an issue, you know. So, you know, I think it's a great problem. If it is a problem, it is a great problem to have. And I'm just tickled pink with the continued development of Ryan Rollins, how good he looks and all that good stuff. So, anyway, we'll see kind of how it progresses. But, yeah, Usman Jang, that's the emergence, the breakout game with him. Cormac Ryan had his career high 25 in that same Rocket game and looked really – now, I'm going to throw this out there. This, you know how Dad likes to stir up stuff. If you're AJ Green, are you looking over your shoulder at Cormac Ryan at all at this point?
I mean, I don't know. You just signed a deal, so you're paid. So are you really tripping on that? I mean, what are you tripping on? You know, well, like when you get paid in the NBA, what are you tripping on? I'm just asking.
You've got the security.
I think Ryan's ascent is an addition to the roster.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't think it's a look over your shoulder kind
of
situation.
Is there room for both? It's my question. Is that a redundancy? Or is it room for both? Can you have both these guys as just, you know, your shooter kind of designated? You know, does Cormac give you anything differently in terms of defensive? I mean, AJ gives a great defensive effort.
PC and AJ coexisted, right?
Yeah. Pat Connaughton. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, okay. I mean, I'm not saying that's an exact match,
right?
But I'm
right.
saying that there, you know, there's some, you know, you can exist.
Yeah. Okay. So you can have some redundancy at that position and be okay. I mean, the more quality players you have, the better you're. I'm just asking. I mean, because I really like, and I like AJ too, but Cormac Ryan is, when I found out he was from like Lower Manhattan or wherever Manhattan he's from, you know, he's got that. You know, come on, you know how we like that East Coast. We got that East Coast
swag,
Dykeman, that East Coast. Rucker, Dykeman, and not that they don't have it in Cedar Falls or wherever AJ is from. I mean, they got it too. Don't get me wrong. One of the toughest guys I played against is from French Lick, Indiana. So if you can get some toughness in French Lick, that's Larry Bird. You can get some toughness in French Lick.
Oh, the guy you wrote the poem about?
Yeah. You can get some toughness and some oldness. You know, Larry Bird working as a garbage man in French Lick used to play against this group of other black garbage men at lunchtime. They had a hoop. They had a hoop at the garbage factory, and they would get together at lunch. And he talks about it. I mean, the trash talking. They would come at him, and that's where he developed a lot of his swag and toughness and that edge that he has. So, and not to say that, you know, it's a racial thing component and all that, but you understand what I'm saying. You want toughness. You go to the playground. You go to the inner city playground, and you get out there and you ball against the toughest guys. Talent-wise is another thing, but just that mental toughness in terms of being able to absorb the trash talk. Final point, and I said that was the final point, but I just remembered we had a brief discussion. I want your opinion on this. Do you think players are better off, young players, like Tyler Smith, overtime elite, like A.J. Johnson playing over in Australia? I got to throw the Thompson twins in there because they, you know, they are kind of the opposite end of my theory here. But I had this theory I put on the air, and I want your opinion. Would a Tyler Smith and AJ have been better off going to a high major Texas, wherever D1 program where you're playing against 20, 25,000 fans from the opposition in a hostile environment. You're playing with other NBA caliber talents out there on the floor with you, as opposed to the overtime elite where it's a lot more homogenized or whatever the word is. I mean, you know, what do you think in terms of just – it's probably – I know it's an individual thing because the Thompson twins have excelled going through that overtime elite program. But my point is it's kind of – it's just not for everybody, that route. I mean, LaMelo Ball can go to Lithuania and do his thing in Australia and be okay. But I just don't know if it has thwarted A.J. Johnson – and Tyler Smith's development, those two specifically. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a situation where it messed up their development. I think, you know, there's so many nuances associated with these type of guys and how they get better, their work ethic, and what they're in the opportunity they're given, that I don't think you can just throw it all in one bucket and just, you know, kind of blanketly say, oh, that situation didn't work, because we've seen it work with other guys. And so it's definitely an individual basis thing. You know, you would have liked to see. Not you, but I think, you know, it would have been interesting to see if Tyler Smith going to a big time program. But it's like, why would he need? I mean, the only reason that college would have been better for those guys is because of the reps.
Yeah.
The live game reps. So that's the only thing that I see that would have been better, because the developmental program at the NBA level is, you know, exceeds that of college. And so it's about playing time. It's about playing in the, you know, in the heated matchups, or, you know, with pressure, with stress, and then understanding how to flourish in those moments. So I think from that perspective, yeah, it might have been better because they would have played more.
Well, and the other point, final point, is that because going to overtime elite, I know Kevin Ollie had a lot of conversations with him about it. He helped start that overtime elite program down in Atlanta. I mean, the guys got paid $100,000, and you could use that money to keep. Get you, you know.
Well, that's not a lot. That's
land
not a
land
lot
cruiser or whatever, or you could use that's that low. And apply that against your college tuition. And now with the NIL money, you know what I mean? So now you're way better off going to college and making making $1 million,
no
$2 million,
it's
$3 million. You know,
Tyler
so
Smith, AJ, they're getting $2 and $3 million. Like, you know, they'd you be know? A no-brainer.
So it's just a question of kind of timing when you were born and where, you know, kind of where you're coming up at. And overtime elite seemed like a great idea at the time because you could make some money, you could develop. But now college, you could make way more money and you could develop.
The rules rapidly changed. It started with LeVar Ball's JBA league that I coached in. I mean, out of that, the G League and all that, like, they changed up stuff.
Did they?
to make it more attractive for homegrown talent to go to college. You know what I'm saying? Because you had all these kind of upstart pro leagues, and it didn't really make sense to go that developmental path. So, I mean, now that they're paying guys, you know, but I think colleges are still a little behind on the developmental path. The ones that have mastered it and are ahead of the curve are producing the best pros or producing the best players, and they're going deepest into the NCAA tournament.
So the Dukes, the Illinois, with the way they're going about it, Houston,
Arkansas,
Houston with Kelvin Sampson, they've got a better feel in terms of preparing these guys. You know, when these guys come there, they want to be one and done. They want to go to the NBA as quick as possible.
UConn,
UConn, great. Danny Hurley does a tremendous. He may be the best at that. And once you embrace that reality, then you can attract the five-star blue chippers, and you can sustain your UConn level, you know, Final Fours for how many ever years in a row in NCAA championships. So, yeah, I mean,
but it's all about player development, MJ. Yeah. It's all like, you know, like we've always talked about. At the end of the day, it's about getting better every single day, and who is overseeing that process, and what program are you on? That's all. That's what it's all about. Player development.
All right. Well, listen, man, I'm going to let you get out of here. Great talking to you. You know, what goes up goes in, as you can see. And right after this quick little respite, we're going to be back with Mark Kestisher. He is the lead ESPN NBA radio analyst. He called the Bucks finals in 2021. Going to talk about some of his favorite moments, broadcast partners, and also his take on the Hall of Fame. Here, District, Marcus Johnson, Chris Johnson, still the only father and son combination to win a national championship at the same school. Thank you, Braylon Mullins. All right, welcome back to Here District. Marcus Johnson, Chris Johnson, and we are privileged to be joined today by a gentleman who is the lead play-by-play broadcaster on NBA radio, or excuse me, ESPN radio. He called the NBA finals. He calls the All-Star games. also calls a lot of college sports, NFL, Major League Baseball. Mark Kestershire. Mark, welcome to the Here District, man. Pleasure to have you.
Mark, it's great to be on with you. Chris, you as well. And always been privileged to have a chance to call a lot of sports. The NBA has always been my favorite. Enjoyed my times in Milwaukee and hope we get more assignments there soon.
Well, look, man, so one of those times in Milwaukee was pretty historic. You called the finals in 2021, first finals championship for the Bucks in 50 years. You and Doris Burt and John Berry, just some memories about that experience for our Milwaukee fan base.
Well, the first thing before we even get to the finals was we were doing all of our games at a studio that year coming off of COVID. And I wasn't sure if ESPN Radio was going to let us back out on the road. I remember kept asking my bosses all year long because TV was starting to get out there. But I thought for sure that might be it. I might be doing games from my house for the rest of, you know, my lifetime. And then one day they said, hey, conference finals and finals. We'll have you out there. And so I remember doing those games. We weren't on the floor in Milwaukee or in Phoenix. We were up in the booth, luxury booth. And I mean, peak Giannis. Oh, my goodness. The block shot, the 50-point game. Being down 0-2, I wonder where everyone in Milwaukee was thinking after those first two losses in Phoenix. But that was a fun series. And then we come off of that, obviously, and we're kind of more back to quote-unquote normal after that. But that was kind of the end of the abnormality of our broadcasting from studios and from bedrooms and closets and then finally getting back in the arena. And it was you know, like you said, 50 years for Milwaukee. It brought back a lot of memories, I'm sure, for Bucks fans of a certain age. And you never forget those championships.
Now, I understand you've got a story for us about almost having to hold down some even more substantial, not some more substantial, but different duties than what you're normally used to.
I'd like to tell you I had some hair on my head before that final started. But if I had, it would have all fallen out. I think it was game four. In Milwaukee, I remember being at the Pfister Hotel, and I got a phone call around noontime from someone from ESPN, and they said, hey, we need you to go take a COVID test. Here's the address. You know, we've got a car waiting for you. Head on down. And I'm like, well, why do I need to take a COVID test? I just took one, you know, like yesterday. And they were like, well, just so you know, Mike Breen was with somebody last night who just tested positive, and now he's got a test. And if he's not available, you're doing the game with Jeff Van Gundy and Mark Jackson.
Wow.
And then everything went slow motion from there. Like, I've done TV games before, but never of that magnitude. Certainly not on the A team, and certainly not an NBA final. So it just dawned on me that what's about to happen to me? I'm in my little comfort zone in radio. Whenever I do a TV game, I overthink it a million times. And I had conversations throughout the day after the test that I didn't have the answers to yet because they weren't immediate about how, you know, you're basically sliding into a Rolls Royce. You know, you just have to start that engine, put it in first gear, and just don't mess it up.
Don't crash it. Don't crash
it. Don't crash it, baby.
It's really not much you have to do. Just, you know, there's no takeoff and landing. Just fly this thing on autopilot. So anyway, about 2 hours later, it's 4 o'clock. We're getting ready to head over to the arena. My understanding is, and you could ask Brian Anderson, who's in Milwaukee, you know, for a lot of the year doing Brewers games. My understanding was they knew he was in Milwaukee. They called him and said, hey, can you do radio for the NBA finals? Here's the situation. And Brian hadn't done an NBA or basketball radio game in probably years to that point. So he might have been just as nervous as I was. And then I got the call about 4 o'clock that said, Mike passed, you're good. And then I had to call Doris Burke and John Berry and break the news, which for me was exciting. For them, they were like, man, we were looking forward to trying play-by-play. What the heck? We wanted to do this game. But my
Go ahead. You're almost wet. Go ahead.
My almost brush with fame. I always tell my wife, you know, who said this could have been like the greatest night of your life. Who knows where you'd be right now? And I said, it could have been the greatest night or it could have been the end of my career. I'm not sure which.
Well, it's funny you say that because I remember this has always been one of my dreams to have things kind of shake out this way. But I was watching a game and Jim Jackson was doing a game and whoever he was working with either had some serious audio issues. And the producer probably asked for Jim Jackson's headset and mic. And Jim was like, no, I'll do the play-by-play. And for a good 10-minute stretch, man, he did, did a really good job. And I've always kind of just had a fantasy about my partner, Lisa Bynes, and like losing her voice, you know, and like, Marcus, slide over and do play-by-play. But talk to our listeners, man, about the challenges in both. Is there a major difference? I work with Dave Kane, our radio guy. He'll fill in for Lisa when she's doing the NCAA tournament. But just the differences between doing the two. Do you see an appreciable difference or is it pretty much the same?
You know, I do see an appreciable difference. I think they're two different art forms. You know, what we do is so descriptive. You know, some days I have a producer who'll be, you're on your verb game today. And I'm like, what? And I'm like, oh, yeah. You know, I have different, even adjectives, you know, whatever. There are different ways to describe things, location. You know, I call it gas bagging through the day. If I worked with Alan Hahn on a Knicks game recently and we hadn't worked together. And I said, Alan, I'm going to apologize in advance for being the gas bagger here because I'm the one who's talking all the time because we have to assume that all of our listeners cannot see unless they're linking up audio with video, which is a small percentage. And so there's so much description. And then you get to TV and you can over-describe, but you may have worked with play-by-play guys that are just talking too much. And
yeah, Dave Kane.
And I love Dave, by the way.
I do too.
And I have had analysts in a very nice way, you know, take me aside and say, hey, maybe you should talk like 35% less. And I'm like, 35%? What is that? You know, weaving stories, you know, what you do on television, you guys make it look so smooth. And there's, you know, the multiple people in your head talking to you. It's a team effort from the truck to the booth to the folks that are there, you know, supporting you at the table. And in radio, it really is like the two of you just sitting there having a conversation. And I assume nobody's listening. So when I actually get like calls and texts and emails, complaints or otherwise, I'm like, it's nice that somebody's actually listening. But it is, to me, a very different art form, even though they're similar.
Mm-hmm. Now, I work with a guy, Mark, with UCLA. Chris was a freshman, but I worked with UCLA radio for a couple of years. And this guy, Chris Roberts was his name, the late Chris Roberts, outstanding play-by-play guy for the Bruins in basketball and football. And at the end of every broadcast, he used to always give credit to Lou Stauer, our engineer. And
Lou.
Lou, and the broadcast, you know, whatever company we were broadcasting for. Then he would always say, and I want to give a special thanks to Bob Lapierre for doing stats. And there was never anybody else but me and Chris doing the broadcast. So finally, after hearing this for like maybe a year, working with him a couple of years, I finally say, Chris, who is this Bob Lanier? Excuse me, Bob Lapierre. Bob Lanier is my teammate. Bob Lapierre. Who is this Bob Lapierre that you always credit for stats? And he said, well, that's my real name. Chris Roberts is my stage name. So he does his own stats. But he would always say, you know, I want to give credit to Bob Lapierre. But now you have worked with, two of the greatest coaches in the history of the game, and Jack Ramsey coaching at Blazer Mania, Bill Walton, Mo Lucas, Dave Torzic led Bobby Gross, Portland Blazer championship team, and then also Hubie Brown. Man, what was it like? Can you break down kind of each of those individuals and give us an idea what it was like working with them and the knowledge that they just are able to just disseminate, man? They're just overflowing with just basketball knowledge.
Yeah, talk about a blessing for me, you know, to get to ESPN Radio in 1999. And then, you know, within 5 years, you know, I'd been hosting their games, but then I got to go to the All-Star game in the finals and hang out with Dr. Jack and later Hubie. And they worked together on a couple of finals. I think it was like 09 through 11 or 12. And not only just the history, like, you know, for younger folks who now see the proliferation of international superstars in the NBA, you know, there was a time where, you know, it was an American game you just couldn't compete on the same level if you were an international from South America, from, you know, the Far East, from Australia, from Africa, wherever. I mean, it was Europe. They played basketball, but they never really presented you know, players that we see now, where I think we've had 7 or 8 straight years of an international player winning Most Valuable Player.
Yeah.
And so to hear the stories of Dr. Jack Ramsey in the off seasons in those early days going abroad, and Hubie yeah. would go with him, and they were basically sowing the seeds of basketball throughout the world. And, you know, some of the coaches who came from those clinics that those two men put on, you know, led to the development of players. And now here we are, you know, where, you know, I forget what it was, 130 international players on rosters as of yeah. All-Star weekend. So it's amazing. And then my favorite part was going out to eat off days at the NBA Finals. And I never had to say a word. I just shut up and listen.
Yeah,
we would talk about what just happened in game two. And Hubie and Dr. Jack, both Hall of Famers, had sometimes completely different views of what the coaches and players did. And they would have an argument, and I'm sure you've done the same, where the salt shakers and the sugar packets and yeah. the spoons and forks, and they would clear the table and they would, you know, put the 10 guys and show the plays they would have run and the actions they would have called coming out of timeouts. And it was, I used to call it like a PhD level college course, basketball 6-10 with Dr. Jack Ramsey and Hubie Brown, and two terrific guys. I was glad I had a chance to call games with. And Hubie, we did a number of finals together. I took over in 2017 calling the finals, and we did 3 or 4 straight before COVID. So I think Toronto Golden State was the last one that we called together. And at his age then, which was now, it was in his late 80s, the strength and the sharpness of mind
yeah.
that we all should have at that age. It's he's fantastic. And it was, you know, great to see. Milwaukee was where his broadcast career ended last year. To see the players of today, you know, he still was a factor to guys like Damian Lillard and even younger, yeah. where they're like, I want to meet Hubie Brown. I want to tell him what he meant to me and what he meant to the game.
Yeah. My former teammate in college, Earl Watson, really speaks highly of Hubie, has a tremendous history with Coach Brown. And he never fails to always bring up one of Coach Brown's sayings or something that he imparted on him. But Mark, I had a question for you, because you've seen so much of this stuff. All-time NBA Finals performances. Where did Giannis's 2021 performance rank all time for you personally?
Yeah, I mean, I've been either studio hosting or calling since 2004. So, you know, saw those Spurs dynasty teams early, the Celtics with Doc Rivers' team, LeBron and Wade and Bosh with the Miami run. Obviously, oh, yeah. Kawhi Leonard and that, you know, extra piece for San Antonio. Boy, you're at your finest moments when you get to those finals, and Giannis stands out. I'm trying to think if there's one or two that stand out more.
Yeah.
He was so dominant, especially in that closing game. And I think it was game 6 in Milwaukee. Outside of LeBron in the Miami years, you know, maybe Kevin Durant in the Golden State championships, you know, KD winning those two finals MVPs. It's hard to find, you're hard pressed to find one that was, you know, more dominated and dominating than Giannis, especially in those 4 games. And it just got better and better as the series went on.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was remarkable. I always think about, your dad knows this, when you call games from courtside, sometimes your view is a little different than everybody sees on television, because you're low and block shots, especially when Giannis had that block, we were up because, as we pointed out, our COVID broadcast position was off the floor. So I could see that coming. That's like football tape, all 22. You could see it. It's an all 10 in basketball. And I always wondered, because I thought my call, which, you know, probably was never heard by anyone outside of our listening audience, because Mike Breen's call was over the top. So fantastic. Yeah. I always wondered, you know, was it a good view from down there? Because to me, that's how I always remember these finals. It's so different as a viewer on TV. It's what, you know, what's your point of view? In 2016, when LeBron had the chase down block on Andre Iguodala, that was my last year as the studio host. John Barry and I were in section 124 of the Oracle, which is right behind the basket that LeBron came to. So I'm looking through plexiglass and you know, I couldn't really tell the chase down until I literally saw a hand and a ball. And then I could hear Kevin Calabro, the great Kevin Calabro, did the Sonics forever, does Portland now. He was our play-by-play guy before I took over, you know, blocked by James. And I'm like, where did that man come from? You know, it's always a different perspective. But that's a long-ended way of saying, yes, Giannis is in the top two or three of the finals that I've been very fortunate to be a part of.
How many finals have you done? How long you've been doing this?
Play by play, this will be number 10 coming up this June. And 2004, I actually filled in for the late Jim Durham, the longtime Chicago Bulls and Dallas Mavericks announcer. He was having some health issues in 03. I think I was game six. That was Spurs and Nets. It was in New Jersey. I remember going down for that. But the first one I was studio host for, and I always remind Tim Legler, now Mr. Big at ESPN, he was my first studio host at ESPN Radio, and it was 2004 with the Detroit Pistons and the Los Angeles Lakers.
All right, so now I'm going to take you back through memory lane and have you jar your brain a bit about your favorite experience. I'll give you mine just to set it up, and really would like to hear yours, whether it's a game or a dinner or whatever. But there was the preseason NIT, New York City, probably around 1993, UCLA, Indiana. Bobby Knight was there, Florida State with Bobby Sura and Charlie Ward, and Sam Cassell. That team, they were in the Final Four at Madison Square Garden. We're staying at the Marriott in Times Square, and it's a late night dinner, Mark, and I'm seated at a table with Dick Vitale, Howie Garfinkel, Sonny Vaccaro, Jim Herrick, coach of UCLA, Steve Lavin, Lorenzo Romar, Mark Gradley. But man, the story, you know, and the stories that they were telling and the things that they were remembering from back in the day, that was and still is probably my all-time great just off the court kind of memory being in this business. Do you have one that you could tell us about that just sticks out in your mind, whatever it is, dinner, traveling companion, whatever it happens to be?
Yeah, you know, I've been fortunate to be in a bunch of them. If I had to pick one, I'm probably going to think of eight more that are better after we finish talking. Sure. But being in the bubble in 2020, which, you know, felt like a hardship to many because you're away from home for so long. And don't let my wife hear this, but we were in a 5-star hotel with a golf course attached to it.
Woo!
Every major broadcaster who you never get to spend time with because you just see them at games for 5 minutes or you see them in the airport for 5 minutes. And so on a daily basis, it was, I'm going to have lunch with Ian Eagle, and then maybe we'll have dinner with Kevin Harlan, and then we'll go call a game, and then we'll come back to the bar and, you know, watch whatever. And then the next day we're going to play 18 holes.
Wow.
You know, the owner of a team or whatever. And then as the season went on, teams started coming into the bubble. And we called it the JV bubble because we weren't tested every day and we couldn't be on the floor and be around the players and coaches. We were tested once a week. There was giant plexiglass in front of our broadcast location that kept us from getting down on the floor. And the side note of all that is, not only was it like summer camp for broadcasters, but, you know, every day we would do a game in the conference finals. Most times you have to do one or the other. You do in the East or you do in the West. So we did Eastern one day, Western finals one the next, did this every day. And it was the greatest time of my life and the most interesting time because when we put on the headphones, they were cranking so much noise in there, you would have sworn there were 20,000 people in the building.
Yeah.
The Lakers beat Miami in game 5 or 6, whatever it was, championship, crowd noise, signing off. Can't believe we did this in the bubble for 5 months. And, you know, we'll see. There's a draft next week and we'll see in a few months. And then I take my headphones off and there's nothing. Crickets. There's a guy sweeping the court. I walk outside the building at Disney. There's nobody there.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, we just called a championship. Yeah. With, you know, 4 months of hanging out with all these interesting people. And It was like nobody was there. It was the weirdest experience of my life. So that's one. I'm sure there are many that are much better than that. But it just stands out.
That sounds like a book. That sounds like there's a book in there or something going on in there. Somewhere.
There should be a book. I'm afraid of some of the details of the book, but there should be a book.
That's what makes it a great book, Mark. That's what makes it a great book, man.
We need to hear it, Mark.
I knew the guy who had like in his hotel room, we weren't supposed to have, you know, like microwaves or air fryers. And there was a guy that had the tricked out hotel room, and that's the guy you hung out with every day. I'm like, I'm bringing my chicken strips over. Can we fry some up?
That's funny. Speaking of Orlando, that's where Doc Rivers got his start as a coach of the year, then kind of segued into broadcasting, had a successful broadcasting career, got back into coaching and just the things that he's done. He just passed George Karl, Mark, for number 6 on the all-time wins list in the history of the NBA. Number 6, Doc Rivers. And just want to get your take in terms of Doc Rivers' legacy and kind of where he fits in the annals of NBA coaches.
Yeah, I hope. And first of all, congratulations to you two being nominated again. This is the year for you and for all the finalists for the Hall of Fame class. My first job was with the Albany Patroons in 1989-90. George Karl was the head coach. He just reminded me of that.
Wow.
GK was my guy. You know, I was like 21 years old, had no idea what I was doing. And Terry Stotts was his assistant.
Wow.
And, I still keep in touch with those two. And Doc Rivers is a guy throughout my time at ESPN Radio. And we were brief teammates for like 3 months when he was, you know, on ABC with Mike and Doris there before he went to Milwaukee. And one of the greatest guys, first of all, as a broadcaster to cover. I mean, he's one of my favorite interviews. You know, there's no BS with him. There's no filter. He's going to tell you like it is. And it's truth all the time. So I really appreciate that from Doc. And he's treated me amazingly for a long time. So, you know, from his playing days to his coaching days as a young coach in Orlando, to his Boston championship where, you know, maybe they should have squeezed out another title.
Yeah.
You know how hard that is. You get one, and 2010 went to 7 games against the Lakers, you know, in Los Angeles. And then LeBron and those guys got together in Miami and they had those great Eastern Conference Finals matchups. You know, Doc is a great coach. And I think one of not only the X's and the O's, and I'm sure you know this better than anyone, it's how he relates to the players and how the players respect him. And, you know, it's amazing to watch. And when I saw his name pop up, you're right. He passed George. All those guys over 1,000 wins in the NBA, you know, should be in the Hall of Fame. It's kind of like, you know, 3,000 hits to me in baseball. It's 500 home runs. Check, you're in. So I feel good that he's gonna get in on this one. But one of the great quality humans in the NBA and has been for decades.
Yeah, Ubuntu. Well, we hope he has success with the Hall of Fame. And it's been a pleasure for me to cover him. And Mark, been a pleasure. Mark Kester, a pleasure having you join us, man, just for a brief bit talking NBA basketball and your career as a broadcaster. And got to get you back on another time. Thanks for stopping by here, District.
Thanks for having me on. Great to chat with you guys.
All right.
Thanks, man.